Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Welcome to the show, everyone. This is season 2 of Sublimely Gothic. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are going to talk about a classic of gothic literature that is actually a satire, a parody of gothic literature, and my personal favorite of Jane Austen's works, Northanger Abbey. Yay!
Yay! I know you're a Jane Austen, you probably like Jane Austen because you have another podcast dedicated to Jane Austen. So I'm really intrigued to get your take on this one and understand why it's your favorite of hers.
Yeah, but interesting note about this, which I just realized by going over Northanger Abbey with my sister on that podcast.
Oh,
you know, Northanger Abbey and Persuasion, those two shorter works of Jane Austen, they were published after her death by her brother. But in actuality, in terms of chronologically when she wrote them, Northanger Abbey was actually the very first novel that she, like, completed, but just set it aside and then went on to Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice.
How interesting. I feel like I'm very excited or whatever, but one of the things I thought when I was reading this book is, like, there are just so many questions I had about Jane Austen, moreover the story. I mean, because the story is very much aligned with Mysteries of Udolpho, but in various ways, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But just some of the history on her writing it. Like, it's interesting to know that where she wrote it chronologically in her work. So what was the last novel she, you know?
I don't know. It's funny that Persuasion and Northanger Abbey were published at the same time, because Northanger Abbey was her very first she wrote, and Persuasion was the one she actually legitimately wrote near the end of her life, and they were published simultaneously.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Again, I'll do a ranking of all the Austen novels, because this was, on my other podcast, this was the first time I had read all 6 novels consecutively.
Oh my gosh. You know, and
yeah. Like, it was an Austen-a-thon.
Yeah, an Austen-a-thon. So you just talked about this on the Austen podcast, you said.
Yeah, recorded. I literally just talked about this and, yeah, went over it with my sister. She, although it was limited, of course, because she has not read Mysteries of Udolpho. So I'm hoping
expand
more upon that element of it with you.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if I should save some of my thoughts for the discussion, but I don't know. I'm ready to get into it.
Okay, then. So, but first off, we have to do our 60-second recap. Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. That was a good song for you.
Okay. What the hell?
I don't know.
It's election day. People are crazy.
Yes.
Alrighty then, where's my alarm? Then timer. Okay, in 3, 2, 1, go. So Kathleen Morland, normal clergyman's daughter, nothing exciting happens to her. She gets invited to Bath with the Allens, goes to lots of parties, meets Mr. Tilney, who is really nice, meets the Thorpes, Isabella and John, who are not so nice. In fact, they're really, really mean. And she has to navigate those social circumstances. And then finally she gets invited by the Tilneys to Northanger Abbey. And things are kind of creepy. And the general is very stoic and not very nice. And she thinks he might be hiding something. And so she secretly goes into the dead mother's room to see if she's either alive or evidence of her murder. And then Henry finds her and he gets really upset. But then she gets banished from Northanger Abbey by General Tilney. And she doesn't know why and thinks it may be because of, you know, the whole misunderstanding that maybe Henry told her. But then he comes back, he apologizes, it wasn't about that, and they get married and live happily ever after.
Beautiful. Man, I was wondering if maybe, like, it's, like, harder for you to refrain some of, like, than it is to give a Okay. Anyway. Yeah. Okay. I have my timer. 3, 2, 1. There is a young woman named Catherine, and she is very obsessed with novels, and she meets a man named Henry who tells her that novels are trash, with the exception of Tom Jones, I think it is. And anyway, so she's kind of obsessed with novels, meets some people, goes to Northanger Abbey. It's in her mind, it's this like, it's Udolpho, it's not. She she basically has this movie playing in her head when she's going through paperwork to find things that aren't there. Henry berates her for kind of being a little, I don't know, fanciful. He apologizes. Things get better. I I'm all over the place. All is well. Okay. That was not as great of a 60-second recap as you did, but...
Yeah, but again, I just already talked about this book a week ago.
I'm probably trying to just, like, digest it, because I just finished it earlier.
Oh, did you? So, yeah. I don't know. So, you obviously... I wouldn't consider myself the most passionate of Jane Austen fans. As I mentioned way early in the podcast, just my school curriculum did not really cover 18th century or 19th century literature. It was either... all like 16th century Shakespeare or 20th century classics. So I didn't get Jane Austen until later as an adult. And, you know, now I've read them all with my podcast. But what about you? Where do you stand in the Jane Austen fan spectrum?
Oh, man. I don't.
I'm making lots of funny noises today.
I know. I'm like,
Was it one of those days at work?
I actually didn't work today. So it's probably like me and my actual personality is coming through, not my like totally drained personality. Well, the reason I kind of hemmed and hawed is I have a lot of friends and just kind of like in this circle that I travel in who really passionately love Jane Austen. And, you know, Pride and Prejudice is their favorite book and they've read it 50 times or they read it once a year. That's just never been the case for me. So, okay. Well, good. I was interested to like read this Jane Austen work. It's one that I was less familiar with, because Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility, to me, those are the two that I'm like,
yeah, they dominate everything.
Yeah. And everybody's in love with Mr. Darcy and all of that. And I felt like this felt like a Jane Austen novel. But I also, like, one of the things that I took away was I didn't really realize how funny she was. Like, her writing is really, like, Henry made me laugh a lot. Just because he's kind of a dick. But, he's clever.
Henry is nice. It's John Thrope who's a dick.
Well, maybe it was just, like, the witty, like, little cutting remarks. So I mixed up the character names. I'm sorry. But, so if we weren't talking about it on the podcast, I probably wouldn't have read it. But,
yeah,
but I'm glad to have one like Jane Austen. No, I think this would be the second Jane Austen book that I've read. I've read Pride and Prejudice, but it's been a long, long time ago. I just feel like there's also an innate familiarity with Pride and Prejudice in our society. But
of course, and through my Austen-a-thon, you know, it was the first time I was reading Persuasion, and it was the first time I had read Emma as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd read the others beforehand. And it's kind of interesting for me because Northanger is my favorite of all of them. But at the same time, Northanger Abbey, again, it's a parody of Gothic literature, but it's a special kind of parody because usually when it comes to Austen's works, I actually prefer her more serious ones like Persuasion and like Mansfield Park. And my, you know, ones that are, like my absolute least favorite one is Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know, because I feel like Pride and Prejudice is so witty and so funny that it's almost non-realistic in a way.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know, I can't describe it, but I know I'm very odd of a Jane Austen fan that Northanger Abbey is my favorite and Pride and Prejudice is my least favorite.
I think it's more interesting that this is the one that you gravitated toward. I found it really interesting, the mention of other Gothic literature you know, when they're talking about the novels, and she's kind of, Catherine is kind of being mocked for reading the novels. I have read most of Tom Jones, which is a novel they mention in the book. I had to read it for a class. Eh, not for me.
Was it the Gothic Monsters class?
No, this was like a, oh gosh, what was it? It was like an English lit class. And I think it was just about, you know, the novel. And Tom Jones was one of the books we had to read. And it just, I don't know, it didn't do a lot for me. But it was, it kind of is also a little nice to hear like the names of those books be mentioned in this, in these books. And how, I'm really curious to get to the Gothometer, because I'm just very, very curious how we'll both, read this. But,
of course.
And please forgive me if I, you know, you can cut this out, obviously, but you had mentioned like Catherine was the heroine that you kind of felt you identified with and in this novel. So do you want to talk about that, or is that?
Of course. You know? Yeah. Yeah. I talked about it in my other podcast. So Catherine Morland so much reminds me of myself, especially my younger self, just because she's a really nice, sweet girl, likes to have her head in a book, but doesn't perceive herself as overly talented or anything. But so I relate to her because, you know, her whole interaction with the Thorpes, with how they're so obviously mean to her, but she's really hesitant to like judge them or make her own opinions about them. And right. She's trying to tell herself like, you know, oh, maybe I'm just missing something, or like, you know, maybe I'm not reading this correctly. The just the fact not trusting her own judgment about maybe the bad intentions of people because she's lived such a sheltered life.
Yeah.
I totally relate to that, because I felt when I was in high school, I was in a very, I was sheltered in a way that actually all the kids in my high school were actually quite mature. A lot of them were children of older parents like me. They took their studies very seriously. They took searching for college very seriously. And so if anything, my high school was more what I envisioned college to be. But then when I got to actual college, when I went across the country to New York, upstate New York, and they're all partying, going absolutely insane and being like basically little brats, and basically I'm like, what, this is high school when they were supposed to be older and better and they're not.
Right.
Yeah. So I just totally relate to Catherine again, just being very sheltered to the point that you are very hesitant to presume bad intentions of people. Cause if you assume bad intentions, oh, that's so that thinking that it reflects so badly on me that I would dare to even consider that notion.
That's interesting. I think, I mean, I can relate to that too. I feel like I still am guilty of that sometimes, you know, which has been to my detriment.
Because we're Hufflepuffs.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly right. You know, and it's unfortunate that you kind of have to, learn to kind of program yourself in a certain way. But I guess that's just something like learning to read people is something that we all kind of figure out eventually. And she figures out throughout the story, starting off at 17, which is, I read, a lot younger than some of her other Austin's heroines. And yeah, interesting.
Yeah, because especially, again, I had a few John Thorpes in my like freshman year of college. And I'm just looking back and I'm like, how on earth did I indulge these people for so long and didn't just say, screw you?
Just some, and I'm sorry, I confused, for some reason, I think it's just like the kind of witty writing that Austin has with her, between her female and male characters. That sometimes I'm like, yeah, it's kind of sure. So just kind of like some arrogant John, just some arrogant people in high school, you said?
No, in college, oh, okay. Actually.
Yeah. Now I feel like I've kind of knew some people like that. I could name names, but I'm not good at names. But interesting.
Yeah, I refuse to give them such notoriety.
Yeah, there we go. Exactly.
So it was interesting to look at this You know, because a lot of people to this day, you know, kind of poke fun at Gothic literature for being so melodramatic and stuff. And so, you know, when you read someone like Anne Radcliffe with The Mysteries of Udolpho, you think, oh, you're getting a true, like, vision into, you know, how people wrote and, like, maybe how people thought at that time. And Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey really shows us that even back then, you know, people were making fun of the melodrama of it all.
That was really surprising to me. Like, when we talked about this and knowing that this was a satire, I thought, like, naively, I didn't really realize that that was something that would somebody would do. I always kind of perceive, like, society prior to, I don't know, society of Jane Austen's era as very polite and, like, not, you know, writing a satire that almost feels like kind of, Hasty Pudding Society or National Lampoon, somebody always puts out like a sat or, you know, like a novel to mock a popular novel. I know there's one about Twilight, but so it was kind of surprising to me. And then kind of her characterizations of the characters were a little over the top. And it's like, okay, I see what you're doing. You know, like everything was a little exaggerated, I think, with Catherine and her. Do you think her naivety was exaggerated, or do you think that was written in earnest? I guess
I think that was written in earnest. I feel like some of the things that happened around her were exaggerated. Like, in many ways, I felt like when I was reading the book, like, the way she dramatizes, you know, again, she's just a teenager in Bath, you know, trying to navigate these social situations, and it is true, like, John Thorpe and Isabel Thorpe are being really pain in the butt, but, yeah. You know, the way they position her is like, oh my god, I forgot to go, I didn't go on my walk with them, I must tell and explain everything. Like, I feel like, you know, everything, like, it was just like everyday situations, but she played it up to the same gothic flair.
Yeah,
as one might expect to, like, you know, the general kidnappings or forced marriages or whatever.
Right, just the heightened drama.
Yeah, and in many ways, you know, I feel like the Thorpes, in terms of how they, you know, coerce Catherine into doing things or trying to persuade her, I feel like that genuinely does, they generally do represent that those sort of coercive forces that are prevalent in Gothic literature.
Yeah. That's a good observation. Thinking about that. So, but, and then obviously this is not in any way in supernatural ways, but I'm thinking of, for some reason, I feel like if I would have also read The Monk, that would help me out with this. But
I was looking at, you know, sort of academic articles about Northanger Abbey, and not so much The Monk, but a lot of them say, like, the two ones to understand Northanger Abbey deeply is Mysteries of Udolpho and Castle of Otranto, which we did read.
Oh, yeah. Well, that makes total sense. Because, yeah. I mean, when we're reading it, it was almost, well, I mean, I guess hence the satire. She took the plot of Mysteries of Udolpho and then was like, and now I'm going to just put my spin on it. Which, you know, whatever. It was enjoyable.
Yeah. So let's talk about, because I didn't get to go too in-depth with this in my other podcast. So let's talk about the parallels between Mysteries of Udolpho and Northanger Abbey. So, like, were there any glaring examples that came out to you?
I think her traveling to Northanger Abbey was just like the main character whose name escapes me in Mysteries of Udolpho.
Emily.
Okay. Traveling to Udolpho. There, it just felt like the trajectory was similar of the story. And there was another key point that I was thinking, oh, I mean, the finding the receipts, right? That was something that was, yeah. And so that was kind of very deliberate and obvious. And then there was one more, I even felt like the ending was reminiscent of Udolpho in kind of the, like, Catherine is playing this whole story in her head, which I guess I could relate to some of that as well. You know, sometimes that story is more interesting than what's going on in real life. There, the end of it, just kind of that tangled mess of misunderstanding, felt very much like Mysteries of Udolpho. Ugh, I can't say that. How about you? What do you think?
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely the trajectory. And I think it's interesting that Northanger Abbey was published after her death. So it wasn't Jane Austen who decided, I'm going to name this Northanger Abbey. Her brother made that decision.
Did she and her brother have a good relationship?
I'm pretty sure they did.
Okay.
I think, yeah, like, yeah, they had a pretty good relationship. And then, so yeah, he was the one who thought of Northanger Abbey. And I thought that was an interesting parallel because in actuality, in the whole 700 pages of Mystery of Udolpho, you're only at Udolpho for 200 pages.
Right.
And so, but the image and the, you know, fantasy of Udolpho is present, you know, throughout, you know, in the book and all its terrors and horrors. And so I felt like it was paralleling that it's this, even in the Gothic novel itself that wasn't being a parody, you know, she was mirroring that same amping up all the melodramatic flair within this right. one building, which in actuality you're only there for it for a little bit, but it permeates the whole novel.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering why she chose Bath as the primary, the beginning.
Yeah, location. That's one criticism people have of if it's supposed to be a Gothic parody, because so much of what happens in Bath and those sort of social interactions, that's very typical of Jane Austen's, you know, other works as well. So like the first half of it is just normal Jane Austen novel, and then we get to Northanger Abbey and get the parody.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of like, other than the mentions of Catherine reading the Gothic novels and discussing them, it didn't feel like not a Jane Austen novel. And yeah. I guess that's because it was written by Jane Austen, but it wasn't like a huge deviation for her, which I kind of went into it thinking it might be, but it wasn't.
Yeah, no, it wasn't really. And here, I have a note here, like, again, parallels with Udolpho is Catherine's fight with the Thorpes about going out with them mirrors the way Montini tries to force his will on Emily in Mysteries of Udolpho. Again, yeah. The Thorpes, again, even though it's at this very micro, simple social interaction level, we're having our heroine, you know, basically her will trying to be subdued by these outer forces.
Right. Yeah, that, and that's kind of like, that's prevalent for women in Gothic literature. Is we've talked a lot, I think, on this podcast about lack of choice on women's part.
Yeah, and then actually, so there comes a point where John Thorp is about to leave Bath. I forget where. I think he's going up to London for a little, and he has this conversation with Catherine before he leaves that he's kind of, I think he's deliberately being obtuse so he can say that, oh, like, Catherine is so into me, and, you know, Isabella tells Catherine this, and Catherine's like, no, I didn't mean that at all. Like, to me, I think that was a direct parallel to the thing in Mystery of Udolpho when Emily was talking to evil Montini about, like, she thought she was talking to him about the fact that someone rented out her old home, her old manor house, but in actuality, he was talking about a supposed engagement between her and Count Murano, and he was deliberately being obtuse to try and trick her into accepting this whatever.
Yeah, I'm trying to rack my brain for that part of Udolpho. The deceptive male character is trying to trick these ladies into just achieving their will, not the women's will, by trickery and deception, which I feel like that's almost just kind of pervasive on all kinds of different stories, but it definitely is. Well, that's obviously the reason they did that, or not. And I just spun out. I'm sorry. That's why Austen did that, is because that was a, you know, kind of a storyline in Mysteries.
Yeah. And in Mystery of Udolpho, they specifically, Montini is in, what is it? You know, Emily's saying, by what right do you have to demand this marriage? I mean, you have no legal standing to do so. And he's like, what right? The right of my will. And basically, if you won't do what I say, I will make your life living hell.
Yes. Yeah. And we talked a bit about that last time.
When we talked in depth about that.
Yeah. Right. I don't know. Some people are just dicks, I guess. I don't know. And unfortunately, you know, something I keep in mind when I'm reading this is the experience of the female characters and the lack of choice, which we've talked about again at length on this podcast. So, you know, I was trying to have to pull back my modern day judgment on some of the choices that these people make because, you know, it is something of the time. We can continue on. I have a question later, but.
Okay. Yeah. Well, definitely, you know, John and Isabella are kind of the more direct antagonists for Catherine in Bath. But then we get introduced to General Tilney, which is Henry and Eleanor's father. And he is definitely supposed to be the stoic, dark, you know, my way goes, and like Montini and, you know, the others in Anne Radcliffe's work. So
yeah,
what'd you think about him?
Well, he was the one, and I think I was going to talk about a different character who's female, but that he's kind of got a preoccupation with money and eating a lot and wants to marry his kids off to rich people. So there's definitely a level of, oh gosh, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not vanity, but just like artifice that that appeals to him. And there is a character at the beginning of the story when they're talking about like dressing, just like the different dresses that
Mrs. Allen?
Yes. I was like, why are we talking about these dresses for so long? It's, you know, she was going on and on and on about this. So I don't know if they're like similar characters, but kind of the preoccupation with, you know, material things.
And just an interesting note is, you know, the whole thing is about General Tilney, basically because John Thrope is just talking smack as he always does. You know, General Tilney gets the impression that Catherine is Mr. Allen's like heiress and that whole thing. And so actually, you know, Bath was sort of, again, this sort of vacation-y spot. People out there went for the sulfuric water to help treat gout and stuff like that. But my point is that Bath was much easier to have this facade of wealth or this veneer of sophistication in Bath. Like, you could live pretty well in Bath for not as much money in, like, in a way you just could not be able to maintain. You couldn't pull that off in London. You needed to be really, really wealthy to live it up.
Okay.
Yeah. So Bath was a very special place where, again, you could, you know, put on these airs of superiority without not necessarily having the money to back it up.
That reminds me of kind of some the part of the country I live in, and just some of that. Like, I always think, like, who are you trying to impress? Like, this is, you know, we're in the Midwest. Like, come on.
Yeah, I'm thinking a lot about that too, because it's just funny. Like, you know, when my husband and I, you know, in pre-COVID times when we actually could have dinner parties and whatnot, you know, we would invite like, you know, our colleagues or other, you know, grad students, you know, to our home, and all of them would just be gobsmacked by our home. And our home is not this lavish thing. It's like cute. It's a cute little, you know, lakeside condo that we've puttered up and made it really nice, but it just goes over their head. And I'm like, we're in the Midwest. It's not that hard to live in decent comfort.
Well, I think that's kind of why, as John Thorpe or something like that, the arrogance, just that, that's just, I mean, obviously it's not a trait that is praised in here, but, you know, kind of that, an experience that I've had in living where I live is, people just think like, oh, I'm so great, check me out. And I'm like, dude, you calm down. Like, you know, go to a big city like outside of here and think you're great. I also come from a really small town where it's like, you know, there were definitely not like Bath. There isn't really anything too thrilling about where I lived. But I'm just kind of putting it, like you said, with kind of in the perception of your, like in a dinner party, like I knew people that they had like houses that were, I'm just thinking of like a lifestyle in the small town I grew up in that was probably pretty average in just another part of America. But where I grew up, it was like, oh my God. I mean, people didn't make a lot of money. Housing is cheap, and that's why people live there. But the thing that I wanted to talk about, which we kind of talked about a little bit, when it made me think of Rebecca, a lot.
Oh, say more.
There was some undercurrent of the story. When you're talking about, you know, trying to be impressive with money or just going into a different location, it made me think of the narrator in Rebecca's, the first woman she's like assisting, her kind of desire for to be perceived that way. And I think maybe that's what I'm trying to say is like the perception rather than there seems to be a lot of desire. And that was something that made me think, like, I'm assuming Daphne du Maurier read Northanger Abbey because there were just moments, and I'll try to process through the other ones that kind of hit me that I thought this feels a little like Rebecca, which I know did not come before this book, quite the opposite. But anyway, I don't know if that was something that you picked up on either or.
No, but that's an interesting thing to hone in on again, this facade of being an heiress or having more money than you do, because, you know, again, that's what makes Catherine a sort of person of prey for General Tilney. And speaking of General Tilney, I'm really glad I've read both Mystery of Otranto and Mr. Godolphin, because even though I'd read Northanger Abbey before, I truly understood the subtext. And I think it's that level of deep subtext from those other works is why this one isn't as popular, because people don't know about those works.
Yeah.
Like they think it's just a silly little romp of a tale, but it's like, going really deep into just older texts that barely anyone except geeks like us read.
Well, you made me think of another thing we talked about, which was The Historian, which I felt like if I hadn't read Dracula, I wouldn't have enjoyed The Historian as much as I did. Not that I couldn't have enjoyed The Historian by itself, but it enhances the reading to have read Dracula. So, your experience, like you said, was enhanced by reading those other books, but you had read this prior and still enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And by reading it now, like, to me, General Tilney, like, schemes for Catherine, it reminded me less of Montini and more of Manfred from Castle of Otranto.
Yeah.
Again, and sometimes the adaptations are different. Like, in the book, General Tilney's scheme is to, you know, he thinks she's rich and therefore he wants his son Henry, who she likes, to, you know, get with Henry. But in some of the adaptations of Northanger Abbey, they make it where General Tilney wants to marry Catherine himself.
Okay. Well, that's kind of like, I think, to increase
his level of depravity. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, like his diabolicalness or something. I kind of got the vibe that he wanted to marry her a little bit too, but I mean, I thought maybe I'm just a pervert.
No, well, again, I think either one would have suited, you know, his goals.
Yeah, right.
So let's see. And then what else to talk about? Oh, I wanted to talk about, of course, what is it? You know, the big scene of the misunderstanding, because, you know, at Northanger Abbey, she realizes that Isabella tells her that their mother died, Mrs. Tilney died quite suddenly. Isabella wasn't there, and, you know, just all the negative things she's picking up on General Tilney, she's thinking, like, did something, like, really sinister happen? So she goes to the late mother's, you know, chambers to look at stuff, and first she's thinking maybe she'll be alive hidden in there, because that's what happens in A Sicilian Romance by Anne Radcliffe.
Oh. I didn't know that. I have not read that, but
Sicilian Romance is my favorite of all of them so far.
Okay. That's a little dark, but that's interesting.
And then,
she definitely lets her imagination run wild.
Yeah, and then there's the if she's not still alive and being imprisoned, then she must have been, like, murdered. And so when Henry comes and, you know, they have that, you know, sort of scolding, here it is. Yeah, that whole, I want to read, you know, his sort of, you know, scolding of her.
Yeah.
If I understand you rightly, you have formed a surmise of such horror that I have hardly words to. Dear Miss Morland, consider the dreadful nature of the suspicions you have entertained. What have you been judging from? Remember the country and the age in which we live. Remember that we are English, that we are Christian. Consult your own understanding, your own senses of the probable, your own observation of what is passing around you. Does our education prepare us for such atrocities? Do our laws connive at them? Could there be perpetuated without being known in a country like this where social and literary intercourse is on such a footing, where every man is surrounded by a neighborhood of voluntary spies, and where roads and newspaper lay everything open? Dear Miss Moreland, what ideas have you been admitting? Yeah, they had reached the end of the gallery, and with tears of shame, she ran off to her own room. So that quote, I have lots to say about that quote, because I did not discuss this in my Austin one with my sister, because it was a bit main point about Gothic. So yeah. For me, you know, people think that this is just cute and funny, but for me it's like, oh, even parodies of Gothic literature are racist.
Okay, tell me more about this.
So I got a little iffy feeling when it's like, remember that we are English and we are Christian. So again, going into all of Anne Radcliffe's things take place in Italy and in France. Mm-hmm. And in the past, and so this veneer of, oh, these terrible things don't happen in England, but they happen elsewhere.
Yeah.
Then just, we are Christian, and, you know, at this point, England is part of the Anglican church, like, they're not Catholics, so again, you know, bashing the Catholics. So to me, it was just like, I didn't like that part of it, because it came off as really, again, Orientalism, like, all the bad things are not English or not British.
Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, that we are English and we are Christian. I mean, it is definitely, there is that level of racism. And that was like, I guess, again, maybe that's just my perception of people in that time. Like, we're white and we're religious and we're better than everybody, which is obviously racist and ridiculous. There were a couple other instances of racism. There was a word, I'm not going to say it, but I had to go like, what? Did I just hear that right? So that is definitely a trait of Gothic literature. And I feel like that's a trait of like British literature at the time. There is a Gothic novel that is about an Egyptian princess, because there's that obsession with Egypt at some point. Maybe I haven't really talked much.
Well, all the excavations of Egyptian stuff that happened in the 20s, and there was a boom of, you know, that sort of.
Yes. Stuff. Yeah. So there's also like this, the beetle is.
The scarab beetle. I've got a scarab beetle necklace.
I dig it. Let me see who the author is, but it's called The Beetle, and it's basically, you know, just kind of like racist Egyptian stories. It is by Richard Marsh. It's a British novel, but I remember that reading that being like very turned off by the racism. I wish I could think of, I can see the cover in my mind's eye, but it's kind of a lesser read story of an Egyptian princess who comes back and seduces somebody, you know, again, kind of with that racism, exotic women, which is ridiculous, being very, trying to think of a better word than the one I'm thinking of, but very, you know, free with their bodies. Yes, promiscuous. That's the word I was looking for. So it's, I can see how reading it as being very racist is that those lines are, I mean, yeah, it is racist. It's kind of, yeah. You're exactly right. When you read it, I kind of laughed, because I'm like, oh, what a dick. But yeah, it's a little more sinister than that.
Yeah. And then also, like, even when, you know, obviously Catherine's imagination has run away with her and he scolds her for that. And, you know, he phrases it as such that, you know, it is utterly like preposterous to even consider this, you know. But I was sort of like, there was no evidence for it. And of course, Catherine was being silly. But just the idea that, you know, him sort of implying that we're in England and this stuff doesn't happen. And I'm just like, these things do happen. I myself was a victim of a crime. And you would think that that person would have been intelligent enough not to leave evidence on their person. But they did.
Right.
And so that... these things do happen. And then again, the experience of, again, my husband's ex-girlfriend,
yeah.
of someone who is just like, I will make it my life's mission to make your life living hell. And so, yeah, just thinking of, you know, these things do happen. It's not like, you know, Catherine was wrong about this specific circumstance because there was no evidence to support it. But
I think that there's a level of, I'm going to try, I know today when we're recording this is election day, but there's a level of comfortability that people have. I'm going to try not to be political, but there is a level of comfortability that I think people have and they want to hold true to that. Like, you know, I live in the suburbs. Nothing bad happens here. I know a lot of people that live in suburbs and there's some weird stuff that goes down in there.
Crazy
you know.
Shit happens all the time.
Crazy shit happens everywhere, anywhere. Cause you know what? People are people.
Yeah. And technology just helps them be better shitty yes. people.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, so that you made a point about kind of some of your experiences in the past. So I'm guessing that reading the Thorpes probably like raised your hackles a little bit because it feels like that was kind of maybe a little personal reading that.
Oh yes, definitely. Okay. And again, yeah, definitely personally seeing them as sort of these people who, you know, are trying to, you know, justify bad behavior. And then again, and then also seeing them as the sort of stand-ins for the sort of sinister elements that we usually see in gothic novels.
Yeah, interesting.
And what's interesting is every time before I buy my books for the month from Amazon, I go to my Goodwill to see if there are any good books because they've been being really good the last few months.
Oh, good.
And so are you familiar with the book or the movie Atonement?
Oh my God. Yes.
I love that movie with Keira Knightley and James yes. McEvery. And I saw at Goodwill, the novel was there and I'm like, oh my God, I have to read the novel. So I took the novel and then I came home and I read the first page. And do you know what the quote was at the first, on the first page before the novel began?
I don't.
It was Henry Tilney's scolding of Catherine.
Oh, how funny.
That I just read because it's the same thing. It's the idea that, you know, in that story, Bryony, is that her name?
Bryony.
Bryony, she creates this story for herself and it ends up having really, really dire consequences for innocent people.
Never have I wanted to punch a little girl, but I did then because man.
Yeah. So I'm like, oh my God, it's so true. And I think that's at a deep subconscious level, which is why I like stories like Northanger Abbey and Atonement, because for me, being a sort of writer and being a sort of creative, imaginative person, I only ever see that as a positive quality. And not thinking that that same creative quality could be used for evil purposes.
Manipulation of that. Yeah. That.
Yeah. So by seeing that quote in Atonement, I'm just like, oh, like this is getting really deep. Now I know why I like this so much.
Yeah. That's a really good observation. And you're totally right. Like there is a tendency to, again, I think it's the Hufflepuffs in us. Like I have been a victim of my imagination, sure. And then, you know, manipulation by people who, I mean, I even feel like it's up until in my work life still that take advantage of some niceties. So it's unfortunate that people like that exist. And it's also unfortunate to me that was kind of the lot of the gothic was just her. I was going to say that when we did our gothometer, but I'll say it now. I feel like the gothic was just in her imagination. I mean, that was pretty much, there wasn't any sort of, I mean, there weren't any monsters in this. There was like, other than in Catherine's mind, it was, I don't know. There wasn't a lot of that. Honestly, you distracted me a little bit with the Atonement because I really, really loved.
I love that story so yes. much. And I saw the book and I'm like, I must read it.
Oh my gosh. I think I have a copy of it. I don't know, but it's one of those that's been on my to read, and the use of the typewriter noise in that movie is just so effective. And just
for all of Joe Wright's movies with Keira Knightley, he always uses my absolute favorite modern classical composer, Dario Marianelli.
Oh,
like, yeah, he had him compose the stuff for Pride and Prejudice, Atonement, and Anna Karenina, and I love all of his stuff.
Well, I guess I do too. I hadn't looked into that, but those are all fantastic soundtracks.
Yeah. So on that note, would you like to move to the Gothometer?
I really would like to move to the Gothometer. Yeah, let's do it, because this will be interesting.
Yep. Alrighty then. So yeah, Gothometer, atmosphere and setting, category one. What did you think?
I feel so bad. I'm going to give it a 3.
Mm-hmm.
Very low. And I just know that this is going to be probably my least gothy book, because again, it was all in my opinion, please don't get mad at me, everybody. Because it so much existed in her head. It wasn't the reality. But what about you?
I gave it a 6.
Okay.
Because the atmosphere, again, it was created in her head, but there was a little bit of it. Again, it was, if we had been in Northanger Abbey longer, maybe it would have been a little higher. But yeah, I gave it a 6.
Okay.
Because even Northanger Abbey itself, you know, she's expecting like crumbling edifices and cobwebs, and it's been completely revamped, and, you know, they remodeled the kitchen and all this crap, and it's like, oh, how disappointing.
Kind of funny, though. Like, again, good job, Jane Austen. It's funny.
Yeah. So category number 2, the past.
Well, I guess, and I'm going to give it a 4. If you asked me to cite a specific part of the story where the past is really prevalent, maybe it's just my addled brain, but I can't really place one right now. And there have been other novels that we've read that are very strong in that past category, in my opinion. But this one, less so.
Okay. Yeah, for me, I'm giving it a 2.
Okay.
Yeah, even lower again. Like, literally the only past thing that comes to mind is, again, for the brief, you know, second of Catherine wondering about the sudden death of Mrs. Tilney. But other than that, there's really nothing else.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's...
So category number 3 is supernatural.
Okay. I'm going to give it a 1 here.
Yep, so did I.
Okay. And my reason is... the only, like, supernatural, it was all in her head. That's where the supernatural was. So
I gave it a 1 because, as you mentioned in the Mystery of Udolpho episode, you really realize, you know, what you like about Gothic literature and what are your favorite elements and which are not. Because Mysteries of Udolpho, and again, Anne Radcliffe, early 18th century Gothic literature, is less about the supernatural and more about, like, more classical elements of romanticism. And that's just, you know, not quite your thing. And likewise, this Northanger Abbey wouldn't be quite your thing either, because it's a parody of that type of Gothic, not the Gothic that you really, really like.
Right. Which I felt very stupid, to be quite honest. Like, having that realization, I'm like, maybe I shouldn't have admitted all of that. But I think that that's okay. I mean, Gothic is very multifaceted, and there weren't any supernaturals in here, and that's okay. Not everything has to have a monster in it. I need to get over it. But
yeah, 13th Tale.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah. As long as it's done well.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So category number 4, heroes, heroines, and villains. What do you think?
I will give this a 6 in that category. I think Catherine was intriguing. We did have some villains in Captain Tilney and the Thorpes. And Catherine was enough of a character to qualify, in my mind, as a, you know, as a heroine. And I feel like that's, again, why people like Jane Austen is, you know, it's a fleshed out person. It's not somebody, like, I feel like if you read the book and you could go, like, I can identify with this character, then that character is written well enough that you can identify with that. We've read a lot of other stories that it's been like, I don't care about these people. So I'm going to give it a 6.
Yeah. For me, I'm going to give it an 8 because, again, I think Catherine was a strong heroine. Henry Tilney was a strong, you know, hero. And then, again, the villains of John Thorpe and General Tilney, I feel like, again, like, all this is at a micro level of silly social interactions that is typical of Jane Austen, but they, all the elements were there, and all of them reminded me of various elements of the human psyche, and so for that, I gave them a high score, 8.
I totally get it.
Yep. Category number 5, mystery. What do you think?
I'm thinking about, so I wrote down 3, and I'm like, why did I write down 3? I think I just felt like I couldn't write down 1. Again, with, there wasn't mystery as far as I read it. This felt like this was a novel. There wasn't a lot of mystery. I guess maybe the receipts could be the mystery. In my opinion, that was the extent of it. How about you?
I gave it a 7.
Whoa, why? Tell me.
I don't know, just the whole idea of the specifically all the things going on in Catherine's head are so intense, even though they're briefly at Northanger Abbey. Like, and especially, you know, her going through the papers, and, you know, she can't even look at the papers because her candle goes out and the storm is outside and she has to run into bed. But then also, there's a chest in her room at the Abbey, and the label doesn't exactly have the name Tilney. And she's thinking, who owned the Abbey before? And that's a direct reference to Mystery of Udolpho and how did Montini, you know, usurp Udolpho from the previous family. So I just gave it a 7 again. I'm typically, as you know, I'm not one that likes an info dump near the end. But I felt like just Catherine's imaginings and sense of mystery was so intense that it warranted it a 7.
I like that. I like that justification. I think that, yeah, I think that that's, I like it. I think your 7 is well justified. You, from my quick totals, gave it 24. I gave it 17.
Oh, wow.
I don't think that, like I said, I kind of, after reading it, I knew that I was like, this is not hitting the points that when we do our Gotham meter, I knew I would rate it low. And I'm not sure if this was our lowest rated one, but I don't think it's one of our highest rated ones.
No, certainly it's not. Again, and it's parodying a very specific type of Gothic literature. And it, quite frankly, it's even amongst people who say they like Gothic, it's a type of Gothic literature that not as many people are reading. And in fact, you know, some, like, Northanger Abbey is the sort of gateway drug into going into, you know, researching Anne Radcliffe's, like, oh, what were these books that she was reading? And if you're really passionate about it, you go and read those books. In fact, for a while, I think there were some people who thought that all those books that Isabella mentions to Catherine, all those potential Gothic books, that she had just made those titles up. But no, those are actually real books.
Yeah, she... So that makes me curious because you're exactly right. I'm being judgmental. Fine. But like I picked up Frankenstein, Dracula. Those were kind of like, I read Goosebumps as a kid by R.L. Stein, whatever. So that I kind of knew like that was my bag as a reader of Jane Austen, having read the 6, is that kind of like, do you know if readers will read, like, you know, they've read Jane Austen novels, they pick up Northanger Abbey, and they're like, what are these other books about? And like you said, the gateway drug. Is that common? Is that kind of some people's introduction to Gothic literature? Or is that, do most people read Northanger Abbey and they're kind of like, oh, I thought these titles were made up. I don't know if you know.
I think, you know, again, there are passionate fandoms both for Jane Austen and then for Gothic literature, but I wouldn't say I'm very confident in how easily those two overlap.
Okay.
And so I feel like I am kind of a rarer person that I, you know, that I'm that as a lover of Gothic literature and a lover of Austen, I read this and I'm like, oh, what are these things she based it off of? And can, and, you know, has the ability to read Northanger Abbey with all those subtext in mind. But other But yeah, because the general run-of-the-mill, quote-unquote, Jane Austen fan doesn't know shit about Gothic literature and just thinks that Northanger Abbey is, like, cute and not very serious and not very, you know, literary, shall we say. But it is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I thought you, I mean, I kind of, like, I thought you were kind of unique in this. And I think that you've kind of affirmed that thought because those two paths don't seem to really, I'm just going to say this. The people that I know that really like to read, like, Jane Austen novels, Gothic literature in any sort of capacity, they're like, you can keep your monsters, Jess. So
yeah. Well, the only way that these can really overlap to engage both spheres would be the level of romance. So like Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights, like those types of Gothic, again, not the hardcore Dracula Frankenstein that you love so much.
Right. Which that's just, that just kind of opens a whole nother, you mentioned romance, and I know that there's like there are podcasts on podcasts about romance novels, but this being kind of like the very soft romance. So I wonder if this is like the drug for a lot of people to get into some of the, I don't know. I'm just sitting here speculating because why not? But okay. Thank you for answering that question. I was just curious.
Yeah. In a way it kind of was for me because Northanger Abbey was the very first book that I chose to read for my neighborhood Gothic literature book club. Okay. And then right after we read that, the second or third book, like right after that, another book club lady, you know, said, okay, I want to read Romance of the Forest by Anne Radcliffe. And that's not the one directly that Northanger Abbey mentioned, but just the idea of hearing that name in Northanger Abbey prompted my other book club member to be like, oh, let's do this.
Yeah, that's interesting. So she didn't want to go with Udolpho. I wonder why.
Because actually, Udolpho is well known, but the one that really rocketed her to stardom in her life was Romance of the Forest. And it's mentioned a lot in other literature. It's Sheridan Le Fanu mentions it in Uncle Silas, and some others have as well. And I'm just like, yay, I've read it.
It sounds like it's one I need to read.
And now we move on to our last exercise, the special rereading. So I read the famous, you know, scolding quote. Here, can you pick a quote at random?
Yeah, let me pull it up really quickly. It's Kindle. I'm going to mute myself because of typing. So hold on. That would be great. Okay. I'm just going to start clicking and we'll land on a page and that's where I'll read, which is, that's what we do because mine's a Kindle. Okay. I feel like I want to go further. I'll slide the thing here. Okay. Me with the noises. All right. Here we go. She had just settled this point when the end of the path brought them directly upon the general. And in spite of all her virtuous indignation, she found herself again obligated to walk with him, listen to him, and even to smile when he smiled. Being no longer able, however, to receive pleasure from the surrounding objects, she soon began to walk with lassitude. The general perceived it, and with a concern for her health, which seemed to reproach her for her opinion of him, was most urgent for returning with his daughter to the house. He would follow them in a quarter of an hour. Again, they parted, but Eleanor was called back in half a minute to receive a strict charge against taking her friend round the abbey till his return. This second instance of his anxiety to delay what she so much wished for struck Catherine as very remarkable.
So this is at the point where the seed has been planted in her mind that maybe something nefarious happened, and General Tilney's just general not so agreeable disposition or overcompensation at this point is setting off alarm bells.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, rereading this passage is, I guess I'm just going to focus on this paragraph. If we're going to talk about to receive pleasure from the surrounding objects, that kind of reminds me of Anne Radcliffe's The Sublimity of Nature here.
Yeah, and how 300 pages could be knocked off if she wasn't describing the scenery.
Yes, Jane Austen spared us that, which is it unfortunate? I guess it depends on you, the reader. Yeah, this also reminded me of another book that we have read and... oh, why is it slipping my mind?
Otranto?
Yes, Otranto. I'm not even going to read. I'm sorry. I'm pulling back. I don't remember what it is. I know it's just like on the tip of my tongue. but it's not coming out. But this passage very much reminded me of another novel we read. Go ahead.
Okay. No, I'm just thinking, again, just General Tilney, you know, his, you know, Henry later admits that, you know, the specific conclusions you drew were inaccurate, but your overall impressions of my father were not, you know, without basis, because he is a very cold and cruel person. And so it's natural to think that maybe he would do something bad. It's basically the Snape complex.
Okay.
Yeah. That you want the asshole to be the true villain, because that's an easy conjecture to make.
Right. It's easy. It's, yeah, it's more fun to make it them complicated.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, multifaceted.
Yes.
Alrighty then. Well, that wraps up our podcast episode on Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen. Tune in next time, and then we will get into our very special Christmas special with A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Yeah, I will admit, I'm glad that Christmas Carol is so short, because Dickens' writing style is not my favorite.
I think I've read A Christmas Carol, but it was like when I was young. And I've never read a lot of Dickens, to be honest. Christmas Carol just felt right for us. And there's
like, look, his sentences are paragraphs long. Like, as a linguist trying to diagram that, it's such a nightmare. And so, yeah, like, I love the stories of, like, Great Expectation and Little Dorrit, but I just don't have it within me to slug through them. So I'll probably be listening to Christmas Carol on audiobook.
I bet there are some really great readings of that on Audible. So I might do the same as well. I'm not sure. But it's always good to revisit that. And my husband and I watch It's a Wonderful Life every Christmas, so it will be good to I'm the annoying person that will be like, well, you know, in the novel that this is based on. So I'll get to do that this year, so thanks for giving me that thrill.
Of course. So yeah, tune in next time for Christmas Carol. Take care, guys. Bye
bye.